Okay, so today I'm going to give a mathematical introduction to F-theory. And I hope this is going to continue for a while into the spring. Next week there won't be a meeting, but after that we'll resume, and I think we'll hope to meet every time until the end of the quarter, and there are going to be some other people giving talks, most of whom don't know it yet, but they will hear about it later. So what's F-theory? Well, so F-theory is a construction in string theory which uses in an essential way a varying excuse me, a multiply defined function with an SL2Z action. So the idea is that you have some parameter space. That parameter space is going to be the target space for some string compactification. It's going to be part of the world volume of the string in the language of physics. And you have a multiply defined function on the complement of some subset of this space. So this space is going to be called B, and the subset is going to be called delta. And if B is in B minus delta, then there's a function tau of B, well, which is multiply defined, multiple valued. And maybe a better way of saying it is that I have a natural map from natural homomorphism from the fundamental group of B minus delta into SL2Z, and an associated single valued function on the universal cover of B minus delta. And it's, so it obeys that kind of monodromy behavior. So F-theory was proposed in 1996 as a way to exploit SL2Z action. The possibility of doing that had been floating around for a while, and the question was, how would you get your hands on a multiply defined function with an SL2Z action? And algebraic geometry provides a method for finding such functions. And the reason that it provides such a method is because of the classical theory of an elliptic curve. So if I take an elliptic curve, now elliptic curve means a genus 1 algebraic curve with a chosen point on that genus 1 algebraic curve. And that implies, by some classical theory, so if I'm over the complex numbers, that implies by some classical theory that E is actually isomorphic to C modulo a lattice of rank 2. So this guy is, maybe I should write it as Z plus Z tau. This guy is a lattice of rank 2. So tau should be in C minus the real numbers, and usually we take tau to be in the upper half plane. So there's an isomorphism like that in which the point P goes to the image of the origin in that quotient group. So this tau is a kind of free parameter describing the elliptic curve, but the algebraic theory of elliptic curves, well, let's see, this was developed in the hands of Weierstrass and various people by defining what's called the Weierstrass P function. So Z now is a parameter in this C, and this is a doubly periodic function, so it's got the right periodicity, but it's meromorphic. However, if you take the Weierstrass P function and its derivative, they satisfy, so if I call that one y and I call this one x, and probably to get the conventions to match the classical ones, this is either 2y or this is probably 2y. Then there's an equation, an algebraic equation of this form, y squared equals x cubed plus fx plus g, where f and g are functions of tau. F and g only depend on the isomorphism class of the elliptic curve, and here there's a natural action. Well, if I take tau to be in the complement of the real numbers, there's the natural action of gl2z, or that's for tau in c minus r, or essentially the effect of the 2x2 matrix of determinant minus 1 is to reverse the upper and half or lower upper and lower half planes. So I could restrict to SL2Z and tau being in the upper half plane. That's completely equivalent. If you act by that, you simply change the basis in this lattice, and you haven't changed the isomorphism class of the curve. And this is actually an invariant of the isomorphism class of the curve. So they're functions of tau, but they're SL2Z invariant. So such elliptic curves provide a natural, families of elliptic curves would then provide a natural source of families of multiple valued functions with a natural SL2Z invariance. And that's the construction that was exploited by Vaca in 1996 to make what's called the F-theory construction in string theory. So this lecture today is mainly going to be about elliptically fibered objects with a discussion of which geometric quantities from those elliptically fibered objects are identified with which physical quantities in F-theory, but no attempt to explain the argument in favor of that assignment. What's kind of interesting is that many natural geometric quantities turn out to show up in the F-theory application, and some quantities which maybe should have been seen as more natural before F-theory came along now are seen as more natural than they used to be, because we realize that there are interesting applications of these things. So, so not interested just in doing this at a single point. I'm interested in doing it in families, and the family isn't going to depend on the upper half plane or the J-line. The J-line, of course, is the there's this natural invariant here, the truly invariant quantity, which is called J, which is 1728 times 4F cubed divided by 4F cubed plus 27G squared. That turns out to be to characterize the isomorphism class of the elliptic curve. But one of the delicate points about this is that if we now want to do this in families, so if we want to consider a family of elliptic curves over some base, then just the knowledge of the J function alone doesn't determine the family. So J is a well-defined function on B, but knowledge of J, actually, more precisely, it's actually a section of a... No, I guess J is a well-defined function on B. But knowledge of J does not determine the family. Okay, so if I leave out this first step where I thought of the elliptic curve as two torus, which was generated by this lattice that had generators 1 and tau if you made an appropriate choice of basis. But if I simply described genus 1 curves with a point on them, then I can do this same theory in a completely algebraic context. So note, this theory makes sense. Theory of families of elliptic curves in very algebraic contexts. So over arbitrary bases, even a base whose name is spec Z, so that's a little scary for a number of people, but that's just a nice algebraic way of describing the integers, and all it indicates is that I've written down an equation in this form, y squared equals x cubed plus fx plus g, where f and g are rational numbers, and then I don't want to get into all the issues of spec Z right now. So that's not quite the most general form that you want to write as an equation over spec Z. But my point is that this can still be thought of as, in some sense, a family of elliptic curves. It's one of the great analogies in algebraic geometry between algebraic curves and the rings of integers of number fields, and it allows us to use a sort of common set of techniques for studying families of algebraic varieties over the complex numbers or number theoretic questions having to do with the same kinds of equations where the coefficients are restricted to being rational, and then you regard the equation as somehow defining something over the integers if you clear denominators in an appropriate way.
So
people would like to know what are all the rational points on such a curve, for example. So the story of families of elliptic curves got a really good start by work of Kodaira in the early 1960s. And parallel work by Neron a bit later over cases like spec Z. So the story isn't terribly different. I have to say that I'm going to assume that the characteristic of all fields in question is not equal to 2 or 3. I'll make that assumption. So that looks pretty innocuous if your only interest is over the complex numbers. A lot of what I'm going to say would work if I were working over a base like spec Z, except that I would have to take special care near the... if I want to reduce mod P, I have to take special care when I reduce mod 2 and 3. The statements change to some extent if you do that. So Kodaira analyzed this kind of Weierstrass situation. Well, let's see. First, there's step one. So step one looks like this. You have some family of elliptic curves over a base, and you complete it to some family of curves that are possibly allowed to be singular over... Maybe I'll originally start with non-singular curves over some base, which I'll call B minus delta, and then I'll complete it to include curves over a base B. So here, this is supposed to be non-singular curves only. And once we've got a base of some dimension, complex dimension 1 or higher, the total space will have complex dimension 2 or higher, and there are issues about blowing up and blowing down on the total space of the family, which can change the geometry of this total space. That blowing up and blowing down business is not typically going to change what's happening with my original picture, where I thought that what I cared about was a multiple-valued function with SL2Z invariance on the base. But it certainly will affect the geometry of the analysis. And so step one says if you're given a family like this, and if you assume that there is a section for the family, so a section means a choice of a point in each of the fibers, which corresponded to my choice of 0 when I had that isomorphism for elliptic curves. In step one, you can take this completed family and you can birationally modify it. So that the completed family over B is, I'm assuming, that the dimension of B is equal to 1. The completed family over B is non-singular. So that's sort of alternative A. Alternative B is you can modify E bar to something that we'll call W. So maybe this was called E hat. E hat could be modified to W by contracting all components of singular fibers not meeting the section. To points. So this leaves me with singularities in the total space. So I kind of have these two options of keeping it non-singular or making it non-singular or leaving it leaving singularities like this. And they both have their uses. So having a non-singular family, and I can assume it's what's called a minimal surface, so that I haven't blown up any extra times. That's the kind of structure that is sort of best studied in algebraic geometry. Non-singular objects are kind of under best control. And being able to get to a minimal surface, that's part of the general theory of algebraic surfaces, which says that it's always possible to blow up in any dimension, but in dimension 2, you can easily kind of blow back down things that you blew up accidentally that created extra divisors on the algebraic surface.
When you say non-singular, do you mean E hat itself?
E hat itself is non-singular. That's correct.
Fibers might
the fibers may be singular, but the total space is non-singular. So non-singular total space. Or I can take all singular components of fibers, contract them to points, and get this kind of singular model. So the first sort of piece of progress was that you could do either of these things, but then in the second case, W, he proved, is actually isomorphic to projective completion of that equation that I wrote down over there, the set where y squared z equals x cubed plus fxz squared plus gz cubed, sitting inside of, well, I should really think of this as a P2 bundle over B. So the correct statement is that there's a line bundle L on B, and F and G, F is a section of L to the tensor 2, G is a section of L to the tensor 3, and the projective space P2B is P of O plus L to the tensor, these are 4 and 6, O to the tensor 2 plus O to the tensor 3. I consider those to be Z, Y, and X in an appropriate, Z, X, and Y, excuse me, in an appropriate sort of more global identification. So you can take the classical picture of a Weierstrass equation which worked one elliptic curve at a time and now study families in which F and G are allowed to vary on the base. And if you're working globally, the right way to talk about functions which locally vary is to allow them globally to be sections of line bundles. So there's a base manifold, some kind of line bundle, and a variation of this kind. When you go beyond dimension 1, these statements are a little more problematic, and one has to put in hypotheses before these statements become become known conclusions. And there are cases where, so part of the problem is that we now have generically a map of fiber dimension 1, and if the base is bigger than 1, then it might be that there are completions which aren't equidimensional. So it could be that a limiting fiber here, which had dimension 1, became a fiber of dimension 2, something of that sort. So you have to be quite a bit more careful in constructing these compactifications and understanding what their properties are. Most of the work on questions in F-theory has been done assuming that we've got one of these so-called Weierstrass models, and at least for today, I'll be working exclusively with Weierstrass models. We might come back later in this lecture series to this interesting question of when can we get a Weierstrass model, what does it mean if it doesn't exist, things of that sort. So, again, sticking initially to the case of dimension b equals 1, Kodaira's idea was let's use the structure of the singularities of W, the Weierstrass model, to classify possible singular fiber types. Let's see. Let me say some historically more accurate things. That's not actually what Kodaira did. That's the modern interpretation of what Kodaira did. Kodaira actually focused his attention more on this case. So he classified the singular fibers here on the non-singular total space, which was a minimal model, and you can then see quite easily what they have to be on this Weierstrass model. So, in fact, Kodaira's analysis was a little bit more general. So Kodaira did not assume that there exists a section of the elliptic fibration, and as a result, got a few quote-unquote extra items on his list in the classification. So I'm going to state it in the case that there's a section, but maybe I'll just briefly indicate what the extension of his result is if there wasn't a section.
If you have multiple fibers, you don't have a section,
and multiple fiber is the one case of, in Kodaira's list which is not going to show up in my Weierstrass formulation. So here we go. I've got y squared equals x cubed plus fx plus g, and now what is going to concern me is the local form of f, g, and the quantity delta. So at the risk of confusing everybody, I'm going to use delta for a polynomial and also its zeros. Delta, which is 4f cubed plus 27g squared, so these f, g, and delta depend on one variable, right? There's a parameter b which has a local coordinate t, s, local coordinate s, and by local form, well, what I'm interested in is the kind of singularities that I might find on this algebraic surface, and the most concrete way to understand those singularities is to kind of blow them up, and when you blow them up, what you get depends on things such as orders of vanishing of various quantities at various places. So let's just get started. So if the surface is singular, then the fiber is singular. And the first step is let's translate x and y to put the singularity at the origin. So this form of the equation, I point out, is missing the x squared term, so you're not allowed to translate if you want to keep this form of the equation. I'm going to have to back off to a different form of the equation. Y squared equals x cubed plus a2x squared plus a4x plus a6. And then to say that I'm putting the singular point at 0, 0 means that I have to have s divides a4 and s divides a6. So then I'm in a situation where when s is equal to 0, I've got a singular point of the fiber. I've got to get rid of the linear term in the equation, and that's as well as the constant term, and that's achieved by such a change of basis. So the fibers are achieved by substituting in a particular value of s into f and g, and then looking to see what the solution set of that is, right? So it's a cubic curve. You know, I'm in an affine chart, but it's a cubic curve. And if I should have mentioned that that y squared equals x cubed plus fx plus g for a particular value of x and g is non-singular. The fiber is non-singular if and only if delta is not equal to 0. So this is the discriminant of this cubic, and if you have multiple roots of this cubic, when you take the double cover, you'll end up with a singular point. So the first step is to translate, to put the singularity at 0, 0. You sort of back off to this form of the equation. Let me point out that to make changes of variables like this, I really need to be in a base of dimension 1. If I were in a base of dimension 2, I might not actually be able to achieve such a such a change of coordinates. Nevertheless, the analysis that I'm going through works in higher dimension to at least tell you what happens generically along various loci in the base. So I'll come back to that point a little bit later. Anyway, I can make this translation, and then I can ask myself, is the surface singular at the origin or not? The origin is now the one point where we have to worry about the singularity of the surface. And the surface W is now singular at 0, 0, if and only if S squared divides A6, right? I've got quadratic, quadratic, cubic, quadratic terms, but still potentially a linear term there, unless S squared divides A6. And if S squared divides A6, then the leading terms in this equation potentially look like y squared equals a2x squared plus s, I'm going to use a shorthand, a4 comma 1x. So it just means I divided a4 by s and an a6 2 with s squared plus higher order terms. And when you do a blow up, all you care about for the first blow up is what are the leading order terms of the singularity at the point that you're doing the blow up. So so now you blow up. So I don't want to go through the algorithm in a lot of detail, but I do want to point out that this case has quadratic terms of rank 2, rank less than or equal to 2, and will continue to have quadratic terms of rank less than or equal to 2, of rank 2, unless S divides A2. I'm sorry, right now I have quadratic terms of rank 3. Let me say that I'll have quadratic terms of rank greater than or equal to 2 unless S divides A2. Let's see if I believe that one. Well, I don't believe that one at the very beginning either. So I guess I have to do one or two steps before I can make this statement. So you do a couple steps and you end up with A2X squared plus still, this is the first, plus S to the K, A4KX, and then A6L, S to the L, something like that. So if you had a situation like that where K and L were sufficiently big, K is at least 2, L is at least 3, or something like that, then the question of the rank of the quadratic terms would really boil down to whether S divides A2 or not. Well, it's not hard to see that S divides A2 if and only if S divides F and S divides G, back in my original F and G. How do I recover the original F and G? I complete the cube here. That's why I'm assuming characteristic is not equal to 3. I want to complete cubes. If I complete the cube, then I'll get an F which has as a leading term, I guess I should do it here, of an F which has as a leading term A2 squared, and G which has as a leading term A2 cubed up to some numerical factors. Everything else is divisible by S. So S will divide F and S divides G if and only if S divides A2. So this is the first basic branch in Kodaira's table. So Kodaira's table, first of all, he gave a name to things, I sub n. And then I need to know the order of vanishing of F, the order of vanishing of G, the order of vanishing of delta. And the cases we were just looking at had no vanishing of F and no vanishing of G, but delta had some order of vanishing, which I'll just call n. So that's this first set of cases where in the analysis I've just been doing, the issue was whether S divides A2 or not. Let me point out something which is useful if you're either doing the number theory case or if you're going to work in higher dimension, as we will in a few minutes. And that is that there's another issue here. So if my leading order terms were y squared equals a2 x squared, then, of course, the tangent directions are given by y equals plus or minus the square root of a2x. If I'm working in dimension 1, where a2 is just a function, local function on some curve, then taking the square root of that coefficient is not particularly an issue. However, if I'm working over a higher dimensional base where A2 itself may be a function on some curve on a two-dimensional base, for example, or if I'm working in a number theoretic context, then the question of whether that A2 has a square root becomes a relevant one. And let me just write the name Tate over here. So there's sort of Tate's question. And in this case, Tate's question is whether A2 has a square root or not. And what it affects is whether the two limiting tangent directions at such a point are defined over the ground field or not. So I'll explain geometrically what that means in a couple minutes when we get to the case of a base of dimension bigger than one. So this is the first branch in Kodaira's list. Really, I should first do I1, where the order... Sorry. That's how I want to do it. IN, and at least one. Then, so now Kodaira sort of goes to town, so I'll just kind of summarize the kind of information that he got. So if F and G do vanish, that's the S divides A2 case, then you kind of go by order of vanishing of F or G. So the easiest case, if G vanishes once, delta has to vanish at least twice. Both f and g are vanishing now. This has to be at least twice. This has to be at least once. If this one is exactly once, and this is 3, and this is at least 2, that'll give me an order of vanishing of 3 for the discriminant. And if this is at least 2, whereas this is 2, then I'll get an order of vanishing of 4 of the discriminant. So it kind of looks like some fun combinatorics. And I should also mention the singularity here. So people have studied singularities of algebraic surfaces and given certain of them names. And the name that gets applied to the singularity here is An-1. An An-1 singularity has 2 quadratic terms and then an order n term. And you can see how, if you went through this branch, you would end up finding singularities of that type. Here, and of course, A0 is non-singular, A1 is non-singular, so this really only starts being singular when n is at least 2. A0 is non-singular. Here, it's actually turns out to be not a non-singular total space. This is another A1 singularity and an A2 singularity. So the type of singularity doesn't completely determine the type of Kodaira degeneration. Kodaira worked out another feature of the degeneration, which is the monodromy that the tau function experiences if you travel once around this singular point. So my starting place was I had multiple valued functions on the base, which had an SL2Z symmetry, and so I ought to try to learn what happens to the SL2Z symmetry when I go once around the base. And here the monodromy is pretty simple. It's 1N01. There's no Tate issue here or here. There turns out to be a Tate issue here, which is whether G has a square root, G over S squared, G over S squared has a square root. This is really restricted to S equals 0. And this is restricted to S equals 0. The corresponding monodromies here are all finite order. And I'll just copy them for you. They're 1, 1, minus 1, 0, 0, 1, minus 1, 0, and 0, 1, minus 1, minus 1. So I'm not explaining to you how one calculates that, but it's not so hard to imagine that you could from the information that we've got. Then there's I0 star, which is order at least 2, at least 3, and 6. So what's happened, I don't really want to try to do the equations. It's getting too messy. But this turns out to be a singularity, which in the classification of singularities is called D4. Following this is IN star, where N is at least 1, which has order exactly 2, exactly 3, and 6 plus N. And this is D4 plus N. And these two have Tate things, which are slightly more complicated, which I'll tell you in a second. Monodromies, this is just minus 1. And this one is minus 1 and 0 minus 1. And then there are a couple more. 4 star, 3 star, 2 star. I do something like this again. So 8, I get 8 with a 4, and here I have to have at least 3, or I could have exactly 3, at least 5, and a 9, or I could have a 10, which I got from 5, and I would need at least 4 for that. And the singularity types are everybody's favorite, E67 and E8. And then there are monodromies, which are finite order monodromies again, which I'll just write down. They're the inverses of these matrices. There's again the question of whether G over S to the fourth has a square root mod S or not. But there are no monodromy conditions on either of these guys. These two are trickier to state. So for these two, the question is, so let's see. So for I and star, I take delta divided by s to the n plus 6, restricted to s equals 0, and I get to write it as, it depends on the parity. So I 2k star, 2k plus 6, and I get to write that one as this A2 over S, which can be defined, if you're careful, squared times something else, B. And B has to be over something, S to the 2k plus 4. And so what we have to put in here is square root of B over S to the 2k plus 4. Or in the case I2k minus 1, I get to write it as A2 over S cubed times B over S to the 2k plus 2. And so here it should have been square root of S B over S to the 2k plus 2. So anyway, it's a little more complicated, this condition. What is the condition in every case? Well, here, these singularities were resolved by some collection of blow-ups like this. And depending on the parity, it's either sort of even or odd. But the point is that we've got the left half and the right half, one half corresponding to taking one of those square roots, and the other half corresponding to taking the other square root. And once we get beyond the A1 singularity, there's an ambiguity between the two sides of the singularity. And the question is whether those two sides are individually defined over the field that we need to be defining things over, or whether there is some way of swapping them, whether there's some additional transformation which would swap them, something like a Galois transformation flipping those two roots for that guy. In the case of the so that also happened for the type 4 and the A singularity. In the case of the E6, as you may or may not know, the E6 singularity looks like this. It also has a Z2 symmetry. That Z2 symmetry again shows up by some quadratic form having two roots, which may or may not be defined over the Graham field. That's why a similar expression showed up for the E6. If you think about E7 and E8, they have no symmetry of that sort. The Dn graphs look like this. And here the symmetry swaps these two edges, which is why it's kind of more involved in the terms of the coefficients that you need to write down to figure out what it is. But the one case which is unusual is D4. That's the I0 star case. D4 has three different branches. The local equation for D4 looks like y squared equals a cubic in... just using the same notation from a second ago, it looks like this, A42 S squared X, and then A63 S cubed. So it's a homogeneous, lowest order terms are a homogeneous cubic. That has three roots. And here there's some kind of S3 monodromy possibility. And because the Galois theory of cubics is a little more complicated, I can't write down a simple expression and say, I would take the cube root of this, and if it existed, that would be the monodromy. But it is the question, I write down some cubic, and I ask how many roots does it have defined over some appropriate ground field. Okay, so this was Kadira's story. It was supplemented by multiple fibers, which only occur at this first line. That's the only case where you can have multiple fibers in Kadira's story. They only apply when there's no section. Tate introduced a practical way of answering this question about the geometry of the branches, which, as I'll mention, will show up when I get to a base of dimension bigger than 1 in a couple minutes. And then there's the monodromy calculation.
So in the physical situation, in 1996, when Botha was first proposing this idea, there were the following constructions. So one had this base, and one had points where the tau function was not well defined, and one knew about certain kinds of these points and what the monodromy was around each of these kinds. So one kind was a stack of what are called ND7 brains. And ND7 brains, in the physical theory, there was a gauge theory associated to the brains with a gauge group SUN. Please don't anybody bring up UN. I don't want to think about that right now. There was, anyway, an SUN component of the gauge group, which is associated to the stack of brains. There was another construction, which was to take the ND7 brains and to put them on top of what's called an orientifold plane. Okay, so I have a mixed audience. If you know what it means, great. If you don't, it doesn't matter. And here, there was a group associated to the thing, which is 2n plus 4, I do believe. 2n plus 8, excuse me. So the association of these gauge groups in the physical theories to these particular objects also came along with the ability to calculate the monodromy for this tau function near these objects. And the monodromy calculations were known, and it was 1n01 in this case. And in this case, is there any chance that I've got my n normalized correctly in here? Pardon?
Shouldn't be SO to n plus k, should just be SO
to n. N brace plus an orientable plane. Then my monodromy is wrong, because maybe the monodromy has to be n minus 4 then. I think that's probably right. So if you compare these known monodromies with what Kadara had calculated, what you notice is that this corresponds to what's called the AN minus 1 singularity, and this corresponds to what's called the DN minus 4 plus 4. If N is 4, oh, maybe it's just dn. Oh, yeah, I've got a 4 over there for the monodromy. Yeah, that's fine. I think it's right. So this was the sort of known situation. Moreover, there's been an association in mathematics ever since the 60s there's been an association longer than that. There's many combinatorial similarities between this group and this singularity, and between this group and this singularity. And there are also more specific geometric correspondences between the corresponding groups, usually taken as the corresponding complex algebraic group instead of a compact group. But anyway, the corresponding groups in this case and in this case. In addition to that, there was already by this time in the physics literature a very clear physical correspondence between these groups and these singularities in some other contexts in string theory, not exactly the F-theory context. So the original proposal which Botha made was that was that elliptically fibered objects, including the more exotic kinds of degenerations that Kadara had considered, should be an extension of this theory that only had the brains. That the kind of defect points where you would have monodromy had to be expanded beyond the two infinite families that were known to include some exceptional ones. And in particular, there were exceptional ones that involved the E6, E7, and E8 singularities, which correspond to the E6, E7, and E8 groups. So these are nice exceptional Lie groups, and they've got associated exceptional singularities. And they're showing up in this F-theory context as the singularity in the total space.
I have a question.
Yes?
And you say it had to be extended to include these? Is there some physical reason or just...
No, sorry. The proposal is that you can use this construction from algebraic geometry to provide a vast array of functions tau that you would like to use for this F-theory construction, but you can only do that if you're willing to allow these other defects. The SL2Z partners of?
Just S duality and type 2B string theory.
Absolutely. I mean,
is the basic physical reason that you do need to include all of these things?
Right. It's hard to put oneself back in the mindset of 1995, mm-hmm. but before Kummer's paper, I don't really remember. I remember this being a puzzle. After all, the D7 brain was sourcing this field, which was supposed to be a single-value field in 2B, and what were you to do about it? And people had constructions with D7 brains and O7 planes, and he kind of put it together and said, look, you could make global stories, but in the global stories, you would expect to find, because of the source of the data, these other kinds of exotic brains. So that's the Kodaira classification as slightly modified by this Tate business. So let me just say, if I take the dimension of B to be bigger than 1, what sorts of things I can draw from this analysis. So if the dimension of B is bigger than 1, it still will be true that on some algebraic subvariety of the base of codimension 1, the family of elliptic curves acquires singularities. The elliptic curves themselves acquire singularities. And that subvariety of the base may still have multiple components. If you ask questions like this, what is the order of vanishing of F along a component? So I'm assuming that this is a component of the guy. The order of vanishing of G along the component and the order of vanishing of delta along the component. What you learn from that question is what is the general singularity of the fiber along that component.
Can I just ask you a question?
Sure.
One of these where you have a greater than or equal to you just said identically F is 0, right?
Identically F is 0 is fine for these cases where it's greater than or equal to.
So
okay.
Just identically equal to 0.
F identically 0 means infinite order of vanishing. So it's,
yeah, but I mean independently where you are on the base.
Okay, so F identically 0 is going to make the J function vanish identically.
Yes.
J function vanishing identically, so another thing which I didn't tell you is that we know J for each of these guys. So here J is infinite, here J is 0, here it's 1728, here it's 0, here it's arbitrary. Sorry, it's arbitrary when n equals 0. Okay, I didn't put n equals 0, good. Here it's infinite, here it's 0, 1728 is 0. So imposing J equals 0 is going to limit which lines you get on the table. And they are exactly the lines where F is allowed to become infinite by these inequalities. One thing I forgot to say was that there's a bottom line here. This is something. So this is called non-Weierstrass minimal. And in the bottom line, I say greater than or equal to 4, greater than or equal to 6, greater than or equal to 12, and then I stop talking about it. So Kadaira's algorithm actually drops out the end, right? Here, I was saying exactly 5, and of course you have to ask yourself what happens if that exactly 5 becomes greater than or equal to 6. The answer is that if f is divisible by s to the 4th and g is divisible by s to the 6th, you can modify the equation, the original equation, at the expense of also changing x and y, to arrive at another Weierstrass equation. So I can take y squared equals x cubed plus s to the 4th f sub 4 x plus s to the 6th g sub 6. So using that same convention that I had for the a's a minute ago of the subscript denoting the divisibility. And now I can absorb everything into a change of coordinates. I think what I want to do is y over s squared equals x over s cubed plus f4, y over s cubed and x over s squared, x over s squared plus g6. So I divided everything by s to the 6th. I sort of combine things in this way, and I have a new capital Y and a new capital X where the new lower degree coefficients are the coefficients for the Weierstrass equation. So the standard way of analyzing these equations is to go through that table, and then if you fall out the end, you divide, and the orders are less, and you continue. And maybe you have to do it a whole bunch of times, but eventually you should be able to reduce down to a case where you don't hit that bottom of the table. From the point of view of these applications to physics, that has a kind of interesting effect. So one thing I didn't mention is that a sort of anomaly condition on the physical theory suggests that you ought to consider mainly cases where the total space of the elliptic vibration had trivial canonical bundle. And this change of variables changes the canonical bundle. So if you had thought you were building a model with trivial canonical bundle, but it wound up in the bottom line of the table, you end up with something whose total space does not have trivial canonical bundle after all.
Not a Calabi-Yau.
So
the physics doesn't force you to a Calabi-Yau, right?
The physics...
I mean, there's no physical anomaly.
Right, so let me say it again. Let me make one important other point about this, which is that the tau function didn't change in this process. So I started out with a tau function, which I'm generating in some geometric way. And if I run into this bottom line of the table, it tells me that I didn't express the tau function in the most minimal way possible. There was a different way of expressing the tau function. So when I'm building a 2B convectification, I'm sort of interested mainly in the tau function, and so I might as well take the minimal way of describing it.
Okay, so that's not the same issue as whether you decide to work with the Calabi-Yau.
That's correct. Right. On the other hand, if I were trying to work with Calabi-Yau, then I might have specified degrees of f and g with a certain expectation. This would tell me that that expectation wasn't actually satisfied, and that when I looked at the total space, the correct total space of the vibration, that it was actually not Calabi-Yau but Del Pezzo and something like that.
So, haven't we now need the closed section of this construction in order to physics if you don't
know? Okay, so the global section. The global section shows up right in this formulation because it's the point at infinity. So the global section corresponds to the point whose projective coordinates are 0, 1, 0 in this P2 with x, y, z coordinates. And if you recall, one way that I described, that I characterized the Weierstrass vibration was you contracted all components of fibers not meeting the section. The section has been thrown off to infinity in this affine chart. So if you want to make the F-theory construction, what you need is a tau function. And every tau function has a geometric model with a global section. So from the pure perspective of the F-theory construction itself, you might as well have a global section. You're not going to use the geometry. There's another point, which is the so-called F-theory, M-theory duality, which says that, which says that if you compactify the string theory further on another circle, that you should have a physical theory which is equivalent to the M-theory compactified on the total space of the elliptic vibration. That's a statement which is understood clearly in the case where there is a global section. But if there's not a global section, there's some kind of twisting of the M-theory data which has gone on, and there have been some proposals for what that means, but I'm not sure that there's a universally accepted answer for what that means. So it really only shows up, in some sense, when you start to worry about the M-theory on the space rather than the F-theory.
But don't people try then to say that the geometry has some fluxes?
The physics could have some fluxes. That's correct.
Does that do something to the singularity?
So if I have an arbitrary elliptic vibration over B, there's a construction of making what's called the Jacobian elliptic vibration over B. Well, that works definitely over non-singular cases, and then there are various extensions of that construction to cases involving bases of various dimensions. So I know that it works nicely if the base has dimension 2. In the case of base of dimension 3, because of issues of birational geometry in dimension 3, you may have to assume that the base has some mild singularities in the course of this construction. But anyway, the point is that I start with an elliptic family, I get another elliptic family, they have exactly the same tau functions, this one has a section, this one doesn't have a section. And do the singularities change? If B has dimension 1, they certainly don't. And they only have mild changes in any case. Okay, well, I'm kind of running out of time today, but I did want to say this one point, since I did write the Tate stuff on the board, about the meaning of the Kodaira algorithm in the case that the base had dimension bigger than 1. So, not what is, but the identity of. So the place that you are on the table in that case tells you the identity of the general singular fiber along that component. But now the question of whether the components of that fiber are well-defined over the ground field of the base is a reasonable question to ask, because I've got that fiber. For example, I could have a pair of rational curves forming an A2 singularity, and the question is whether in the course of moving around in this base, which although I'm drawing it as a curve, it's really an algebraic curve, right? So in the course of moving around on this base, the question is whether those two fibers can ever swap or not. And if the fibers swap, then you have different basic geometry. In particular, this fiber might be numerically equivalent or algebraically equivalent, might be in the same algebraic equivalence class as the other fiber if you're allowed to move around. Or if they're completely separated, you'll have two separate divisors there and they won't be in the same algebraic equivalence class. So there are some interesting issues, and they're exactly calculable by checking this Tate condition in each case of simple ones, and in the case of the IN star, slightly more complicated Tate conditions, which would tell you the story about those fibers. So the assignment of groups also gets modified by this issue. So when the dimension of B is bigger than 1, then the group assignment, so let me say the Kodaira type and the answer to the Tate question and the group. So in the case of Kodaira type IN, when N is at least 1, the Tate question could have been the square root exists or the square root does not exist. I'll just say exists and not exists. And the groups are, when the square root exists, it's the SU n that we were expecting. When it doesn't exist, it's the symplectic group, greatest integer in n over 2. The other ambiguous one here is 4. So if the thing exists, then we end up with SU3. And if it doesn't exist, then we end up with SP1. I know that SP1 has another name. In the case of I0 star, there are 3 possibilities depending on how many roots are defined. So 3 roots could be defined, 2 roots could be defined, or 1 root could be defined, or no roots could be defined. And we get 3 different possible groups, namely G2, SO7, and SO8. In the IN star case, there could be exists or non-exists, the square root, and if it exists, it's SO2N, and if it does not exist, it's I've got the N wrong, 2N plus 8, and if it does not exist, it's SO2N plus 7. And then the 4 star exists or non-exists. If it exists, it's E6. And if it doesn't exist, it's F4. So with this list, you'll notice that all, and you know, I said group, but really I mean algebra. There are interesting questions about what's the global structure of the group in these cases, and I really should have phrased this in terms of the symmetry algebra, where what I've said is completely accurate. But you'll notice that by this point we've expanded to include all of the non-simply laced as well as the simply laced groups. So there's a complete list of groups. Each group appears at least once on the list, and a few of them, because of these sort of exceptional things happening here, occur more than one time on the list. But we can realize all possible gauge symmetries. And I think I won't launch into the question of... So there are other interesting questions, including what geometry in dimension bigger than 1 do we use to associate additional features of the physical theory, which appear there, namely the so-called matter representation, a representation of this group. Well, actually, we're getting a factor of the group for each component of the discriminant locus, so it'll be representation of the corresponding product group or product algebra, and again, that's completely given by, in principle, completely given by geometric information. The entire dictionary for how to write down the representations is not known, but that'll, I think, be the subject of another lecture. Questions? Yes.
In the physical picture, so when you have the torsion part of the group of sections, how does it translate in the physical picture?
So if the group of sections has a torsion part, that ends up telling you that the gauge group is not simply connected. So I was being sloppy here about writing down my groups. But for example, if you want a gauge group, which is instead of, so I really should have written spin here instead of SO, right? But if I wanted a gauge group which was so-called spin 32 mod Z2, which is a gauge group that that shows up a lot, to realize that in F theory, I would actually want a 2 torsion section in Mordell Bay to account for that Z2. And if you attempt to write down an elliptically fibered surface, a K3 surface from Kodaira's list with a spin 32, is pretty hard to do, and turns out to force you to have a Z2. So it's not possible to get without the Z2. Yes?
So what does F theory do with all these elliptic surfaces?
Right, so this was a mathematical introduction to F-theory. So F-theory starts from one of the 5 classically known superstring theories, the one whose name is 2B. And the theory with which is called 2B has a symmetry of the theory, an SL2Z symmetry of the theory, which acts on a particular complex scalar field. And so F theory is a strategy for constructing lower dimensional physical models out of that 2B theory, allowing the scalar field that has the SL2Z symmetry to be multiple value. And so it's used to produce these compactifications. So dimension B equals 1, that was complex dimension 1, that will take me from the 10 dimensions where flat space 2B theory lives to the simplest F theory models, which live in 8 dimensions, and you use the data of the base of the elliptic vibration together with all this monodromy stuff to explain how the 2B string will live in 8 dimensions in that case. Any more? All right.